The narrative tells you how to do it. Do it by fighting the deep state, fighting the Jews, fighting the Muslims, fighting the refugees. And there is a network that supports it, including high-powered people like leaders, the country, like the president of our country. Then you have a social movement that becomes very dangerous. And you've seen the culmination of that kind of process in the assault on the Capitol on January 6th.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. The attack on the Capitol was evidence of organized, radical groups threatening the state. Make no mistake about it, there was nothing spontaneous about the attack. It had been talked about on the web for weeks. The groups include dangerous white supremacists with international links, driven by what some of them consider to be their spiritual leader, the outgoing American President Donald Trump. Think about that. I mean, it's beyond bizarre to me. An American president calling radicals to Washington to storm the Capitol and lynch the vice president and kill other lawmakers because he didn't like the outcome of the election he lost. He didn't openly call for a lynching, but he pointed those groups to the Capitol after firing them up and telling them they had to fight. He called them to Washington in the first place, and he knows those groups by name. Trump has given them a narrative, breeding their hate for immigrants, minorities, and the government they believe coddles them at the expense of what they falsely believe to be true Americans. There were police in their ranks, and firemen, and army vets, wearing body armor and carrying bear spray, and firearms, and pipe bombs. The fact is, police and some military are deeply infiltrated by white supremacists, and the FBI knows it. And some of those white supremacist groups organize internationally. For example, in September, over 24 police officers were suspended in Germany after the discovery of 126 violent neo-Nazi images in WhatsApp chat groups. There's been a resurgence of white supremacy in that country's military and law enforcement groups, and a resurgence of civilian supporters over recent years. The North Rhine-Westphalia officers shared images of, get this, swastikas, refugees in gas chambers, and reportedly an image of a black man being shot. This is a country that led us into a world war, and America fought the Nazis. So what on earth are we doing tolerating these groups within the America of today? What is wrong with people who indulge in this hatred? Well, the fact is, if America was a psychiatric patient, I suspect it would be deep in therapy right now. So on this backstory, two psychology professors on the topic of radicalization and disinformation. And we talked to a philosopher on public discourse and just how ugly that's become. Ari Kruglansky is a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Maryland and is the co-author of Three Pillars of Radicalization. Hi, Ari.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I don't want to give away the three pillars, but they are in the title, which are, the first one is needs.
The need. The second one is the narrative, and the third one is the network.
Let's start with needs.
The needs. The need that underlies much of social activism and violent extremism in particular is the quest for significance. It's the human quest for dignity and respect. It's a universal need, can be accomplished in many different ways. All people have it. The way it is accomplished is determined by the two remaining ends of the three-end triumvirate, the narrative and the network. The narrative basically tells you how to satisfy the need. What do you need to do? Do you need to embark on a constructive career? Do you need to fight for your race, for your country, against enemies that are taking over, that are promoting injustice to your group? And the third N is the network. The importance of the network, it's the social movement. And the its importance is that it validates the narrative. We are social beings. We need validation by people who we respect and whose good opinion we seek. So the importance of the network, its leaders, people who we admire and who want to be admired in return is very important. So the three N's, once they come together, once the need is aroused by humiliation or opportunity for glory, and the narrative tells you how to do it by fighting the deep state, fighting the Jews, fighting the Muslims, fighting the refugees, and there is a network that supports it, including high-powered people like leaders of the country, like the president of our country, then you have a social movement that becomes very dangerous. And you've seen the culmination of that kind of process in the assault on the Capitol on January 6th.
Was President Trump the author of the narrative, or did he simply pick up on it and understand what he was feeding?
He was not the author of the narrative. The narrative existed for many years before. The white supremacists, the neo-Nazi movement, the conspiracy theories have been thriving throughout the decade. There's been a huge uptick in far-right plots by 320% on recent count. Mm-hmm. But he accelerated that process by legitimizing it. Who, if not the highest person in the realm, the most powerful leader in the world, is credible as an endorser of a narrative. And so he joined the narrative, he encouraged its supporters, and the rest is history. The rest, we've seen the acceleration of the movement over the last 4 years. And in the last phase, following the elections, it entered a new, highly accelerated phase that finally led to the events of January 6th.
You draw some parallels with history, like Adolf Hitler, who, went back in 1918, that Germany was, in fact, he said, was winning World War I, and then he started betraying, only to be betrayed by Jews and socialists and et cetera.
Yes. Dana, it's always dangerous to draw historical analogies. However,
It's dangerous not to.
And there is a good justification to do it, because even though the circumstances, the historical circumstances, are always very different, the fundamental human nature does not change. Since the Homo sapiens appeared on the scenes, we have been pretty much endowed with the same nature. And that nature is vulnerable, susceptible to a process that culminates in extremism. And what particularly troubles me is that a fringe group like the Nazis in Germany, that started as a small group of thugs, embracing the idea that there was a knifing in the back of the German nation by the Jews and socialists, then over time gradually crept into the mainstream through the putsch in Bavaria, in Munich, on November 8th, 1923. Slowly it gained momentum.
And which finally, was a failure.
In Bavaria, yes. Finally, it gained momentum to the extent that it overpowered the entire German nation. And we have seen the outcome of that, the Second World War, the Holocaust, and the rest of it. So, what troubles me about the current events in the United States is that this fringe movement now commanded a large chunk of the American population. 74 people voted for Trump. Many believed that in the conspiracy theories that the elections were stolen. Clearly, that narrative, that conspiracy theory, crept into the Republican Party. A large chunk of the Republican Party still insist that there were problems with the election and it was illegitimate. So, you know, whereas not everybody in that crowd was violent and some people were just protesting, the fact that over 60 million people supported this Stop the Steal narrative creates a huge recruitment pool. They shared with the most violent demonstrators the idea that there was an injustice done to the American people, that there was a plot against America. So this creates a recruitment pool. These events are glorified and are seen as a great achievement. So, you know, the process of creeping into the mainstream is probably intensified by these events.
How do you counter that? Do you just shut their network down and drive them underground? Or how do you reach out to these people? Do you need to reach out to them?
You need to reach out. You need to first of all, cool down the rhetoric, reduce the vindictiveness. On the one hand, you need to hold people accountable. On the other hand, it should not occupy the center stage. And you should put in place a process to de-radicalize the American population. It has to start in schools, communities, churches, the police. A large initiative needs to be taken place in which the whole society is involved. It's going to be a very difficult process to put that genie back into the bottle. Because
Larry, there really isn't a call for that. There is a call for justice. There is a call for making people pay and putting them in jail and arresting them. There isn't a call for that dialogue.
Yes, well, at least it's a minority call. What is encouraging is that the president-elect Biden seems to be of that mindset of reducing the heat of the rhetoric, inducing the vindictiveness, and becoming pragmatic about the problems that beset the country. Pragmatism as opposed to ideology, dealing with the vaccination, with the coronavirus, dealing with the economy. And hopefully, you know, he will need in that enterprise a cooperation of the Republican Party, who alone can maybe put a stop or at least slow down the process. We haven't seen much evidence for that. There is some, but perhaps, you know, with Biden. Biden is, by the way, is a very good choice this time and age because he's a pragmatist. He has plenty of experience. He knows everybody and he knows the ropes with his experience in the Congress and in the White House. And he's a very likable person, unlike Hillary Clinton, that somehow was perceived in a negative way by many people. It's very difficult to dislike Joe Biden. So I think all of these elements bode well for the possibility of cooling it down and back to pragmatics and cooling down the ideological heat that has been overtaking America.
Are you a fan of the fact that some of these social networks were pulled down and other people, including the president, were banned and lost their accounts or had them suspended?
Well, you know, it's a moral dilemma. Do you revoke people's freedom of speech? Is the speech that is being propagated in the category of hate speech? This is always a very thin line. So I think that banning Trump from speaking is a good thing. At the end of the day,
especially at this moment.
Especially at this moment, but one has to be very careful. With, you know, not being too much of a censor expressing opinions in the United States.
Larry Kruglensky, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dana. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Ira Hyman is a doctor, a professor of psychology at Western Washington University. Hi, Ira.
Good morning, Dana.
You wrote a lot about disinformation campaigns, and it seems like you are living in that movie right now, because the American public has been, their heads spun around by President Trump talking about false elections and cheated votes, and people don't know what to believe, a lot of them. Would you agree?
Yes, to a certain extent, right? I think that what happens is we get into an information ecosystem, and within that information ecosystem, things hang together. There's a coherent and constant set of information that people come to believe, and they tend to rely on certain news sources. So saying things people don't know what to believe, most people have made up their mind. And it has to do with the environment in which they have found themselves. So it's not that they're comparing alternatives to these sorts of things if they're stuck in the information bubble that tells them that the election has been stolen. They're not seeing the other information, so that they're not being exposed to it. And when they are, it's only if it's dismissed. So it's I think that their critical thinking works against them here. In an odd way when they're in that environment.
Well, I guess they need to have their heads spun around maybe and be a little more open to being a better news consumer. But at this point, people follow presidents. And for instance, convinced of false information from President Trump in terms of not wearing masks. And that was dangerous, as was, that your vote has been stolen and march on the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean the election disinformation stuff about the votes not being right and about there being fraud and all of this was a disinformation campaign with a political goal, and it has consequences. The COVID misinformation and disinformation campaigns are killing people. I think we can just bluntly say that. Because what we've done is, or what some people have done, and Trump has been the single most responsible individual for sharing misinformation about COVID, is we've given people wrong information. We've told them it's not that dangerous. It's not communicated in this fashion, that maybe you don't need to wear masks. And all of these things are incorrect, and they lead people to behave in such a fashion once they're in that environment, and that's the information they hear, that increases the spread, that puts themselves and people they care about at risk. So it has been responsible for not all 400,000 deaths in the U.S., but a large proportion of them.
I think you wrote that people have been swimming in a sea of lies.
Yes. I think that's a good way to phrase it. And so, your comment a few moments ago about maybe people need to be better consumers of information. Yes. However, there's this phenomena in psychology referred to as the fundamental attribution error, where when we look at a situation where somebody makes a decision or behaves in a certain way, we could say it's because of who they are and the way they are and the way, in this case, they approached news and information. But we can also reflect on the fact that it's about the context, about the environment, about the system in which they're working. And in this case, for many of these people, the system in which they're working is what's really driving this, because they're constantly exposed to misinformation and misleading information, and they rarely get exposed to accurate information. And in that environment, you can look at people and say, well, they shouldn't be there, but everybody that they know is in that environment, and they've shut themselves off from other sorts of things, but it's because that environment hangs together. And so yes, people are somewhat responsible, but they're in a world that is more responsible. It's the people promoting the disinformation campaigns that we need to focus on. It's the people spreading the misinformation that we need to focus on. It's on disrupting that flow of disinformation that we need to focus on.
Disrupting the disruption. But
yeah,
the people in the media environment in which false beliefs are repeated is because of these algorithms. So if you express an opinion, that algorithm will likely bring you more
of your own opinion and your online peers, who you've never met and probably never will, your online peers who will agree with you. A dangerous cycle.
That is a big part of the cycle, right? Is that once you start down this pathway, the algorithms that pretty much every internet company is using is going to continue to feed you more of the stuff you like and to keep you engaged, more extreme versions of some of the stuff you like. I know that some of the companies are working on this, right? And they're trying to tweak their algorithms to a certain extent. But let's be clear, I think you mentioned free speech before. This isn't an issue of free speech because the algorithms are already choosing for you. They're already picking and choosing from amongst all the stuff out there what to present to you. And so for that reason, you know, you talk about just tweaking the algorithms a little bit, it would tone down, the disinformation campaigns and maybe increase your access and your exposure to more accurate information.
I tend to agree with you, but I think people who would disagree with us would say it's censorship. And at a certain point, it becomes dangerous programming. I mean, first you ban a president from a platform, and then who is next and what is next? Where do you stop it?
So I'm not a constitutional scholar, and so I'm not going to play
one. This podcast,
one.
You don't have to be, so it's all right.
You're right. I'm not going to play one. But I think that you have to recognize that the internet companies are already picking and choosing what to show you, because they're not going to show you everything. And so in that sense, it's a question of what you want that algorithm to be based on and to what extent you want accuracy and reliability to play into that algorithm. The second part, your comment about if you deplatform some people, move them off of the platforms. You don't just do it to anybody and everybody. And actually, the data, you know, that I've been looking at, there's some really nice work by Kate Starbird and her team down at the University of Washington. A lot of the misinformation and disinformation campaigns go through just a few narrow nodes on that internet, right?
About this, because I mean, I've kind of been overwhelmed doing stories about QAnon and,
right,
and people who, you know, are finding some pretty wild cult-like things to follow on the internet, and right, you have said and written that you and quoting her, I think that you think it comes down to like the mob that moves down the street. There's probably a central core of people that really drive the trouble, and that would be 100 people.
So when we're looking at, I mean, there's two aspects of that. It seems to me. One is trying to stop the widespread of disinformation on the internet. And that widespread of disinformation starts with a few people who post something and then it gets shared widely from those few people. Mm-hmm. And they may not share that many things, although Trump shared a lot personally, but it's the fact that they are both the people who share a lot of misinformation and conspiracy theories, and they have a wide sphere of influence so that they touch on a lot of other people. So that if you really just remove a couple of handfuls worth of people, you can see pretty meaningful effects in terms of disrupting that sort of starting point for a lot of the misinformation campaigns. Now, in response to your other point about, yeah, there are some places on the internet where conspiracy theories and disinformation is the main part of what happens in those discussion groups, but they're not the main platforms of the internet. And so in order to get to those places, you actually have to go looking for them. As you noted,
which brings us to another question, but which would be, is it better to have these huge companies that you can then pressure and try to get them to police, or do you break them up, which a lot of people are calling for, and then you have, you know, some real outliers in terms of, you know, who they're going to appeal to and how bizarre that forum may get.
I'm not going to touch that question because, you know,
it's too now.
I know about
constitutional questions and breaking up the big tech. All right.
Yeah. I mean, I know my areas of expertise. I know a lot about the spread of disinformation and how people adopt it and the fact that it has consequences. I do know that disrupting the spread of that can be effective in, you know, leading to a better set of information that people are relying upon. The actual pathways in terms of legislation about, you know, how it fits in with constitutional structures in any given place.
Do you think we've turned a corner?
Yeah.
After the assault on the Capitol, do you think that people who didn't want to pressure companies and didn't want to go down this road of First Amendment debate now say, if we don't do it, we're not going to have a country?
You know, I think that maybe we've been coming to this, and it's hard to know for sure if you turned a corner. I've seen numbers on the internet, reports of some studies that people have done in the last week that show that there was a 73% drop in misinformation related to the election after the social media companies removed not just Trump, but a few other people and some of the QAnon conspiracy groups. So, it's hard to attribute it directly to their actions, but it seems that it's part of decreasing the spread of the misinformation. The reason I say it's hard is because, you know, things are kind of clear that everything about the election is certified. So maybe we would expect anyway a drop off of conversations about that. But I am hopeful. It feels a little bit hopeful to me for the first time in a while that maybe the success of some of that and the willingness to recognize that not everyone is a good faith actor. And when they're not good faith actors, maybe they shouldn't be treated as good faith actors. So that if they're constantly spreading disinformation and they have a wide appeal, we need to address those sorts of things.
If America was your patient, from a psychological point of view, would you say that you have a pretty ill patient right now?
In terms of the sort of adoption of misinformation, I think that we have a problem with misinformation, disinformation campaigns broadly in the U.S. Yes. And it's not just the election. It's not just COVID. It's the issue of whether or not there's climate change and how to address those sorts of things. And one of the features here is that the people who spread one set of disinformation and misinformation spread the other ones as well. And the people who adopt one get exposed to all the other ones as well. So that it's a nasty information environment right now in the U.S.
You know, I, as a media person, when I said be a good news consumer, I should tell you, you brought up global warming as an example. I can tell you that there was a long debate about it here, and the BBC decided they are no longer going to treat the debate as two sides anymore, that 99.99% of scientists around the world believe there's no question that there's global warming, and they're not going to give equal time to the people who say there's not. And right. So media has had to mature a lot. The old, you know, when I went to journalism school, of just giving two sides all the time and then let the public figure it out, unfortunately, we've been pressured to kind of go beyond that.
Well,
onerous duty.
The question is whether both sides are acting in good faith, whether or not both sides are relying on the actual state of the world and presenting the actual state of the world. What's the bit that if you're a journalist and you got one person who say that it's a beautiful day outside and the other person say that it's pouring down rain, your job isn't necessarily to give them both equal time, but to look out the window, right? And to prioritize the one who's giving you accurate information, perhaps. The other way to think about it, and I saw this last week with the attack on the United States Capitol. News companies had a choice about which voices to feature at that moment. And then again, in the debate about whether or not to impeach President Trump. Again, so many Congress people spoke. The news companies have a choice about which voices to present. So which one should you prioritize? You're not going to show all of them. You know,
you have an obligation to show some of the dissenting voice.
Yes.
But maybe even not there, equal time with those who are overwhelmingly voting to impeach.
Well, or even when you're presenting the dissenting votes, should you present someone who is a fountain of lies? that everything that they say is misinformation? Or should you present someone who says, you know, other reasons for doing this that aren't based on spreading further disinformation theories? I mean, it's what are your ethical obligations as a journalist? I think that that is a critical question that journalism has to address in this moment. The treating both sides equally is reasonable when both sides are equally good faith actors.
Last question to you. I think your last paragraph of an article I wrote was kind of inspiring in the sense that, yeah, people are, you know, locked down and going through a lot right now. And you said your suggestion would be change your information feed for the next month. And?
Yeah, well, and this is particularly for people who thought that everything that I wrote in that was wrong, right? That,
by the way, you closed comments, I will note, because you thought that some people may not be overly receptive.
Right, not receptive. And so I generally leave comments open on things I write, and I'm usually willing to reply to people, and I'll respond to people. Yeah. And in part it's because as a white man, I don't get attacked as much as some other people do. But here I don't need to give a platform to people who just want to spew more disinformation. And so if you're that angry at me for saying that, no, the election wasn't stolen, yes, COVID is dangerous, yes, there's climate change, then maybe what you should do is switch your information feed for a while. Because, and this is something that worries me deeply when we're talking about this. Many of the people who've gone down these pathways have lost touch with friends and family. And I think that we need to recognize that human component of it as well, that they have now found a group where they feel comfortable, but it's a group that shares these beliefs that are not consistent with the state of the world. And because of that, they no longer are necessarily in touch with friends or no longer in touch with families. They've lost some of the other connections. And maybe because they dropped them, maybe because their friends and family really just gave up in talking to them. And I've heard stories like this. I've seen it to happen to people who I know on social media. And so, you know, wouldn't it be lovely if changing their information flow for a while led them back to some connection with reality and allowed them to reconnect with friends and family? You're not going to break a single individual. You, Dana, you're not going to break through that environment for one person who's completely inundated in it, flooded by that tidal wave of disinformation. It's going to take more than that to do that. And so they're going to have to move back out of that flood of disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a family where political views were a blood sport at the dinner table, you know, but I think in general, we still taught each other to be generally respectful, not always, generally respectful of other people's views at the table and actually try to listen to them, right? Because otherwise, why are you holding the conversation at all? If you just go on the internet to give your opinion, then, you're really not engaging with anybody. You're just engaging with yourself. So,
yep. Anyway, I would hope people would be able to do that again in the future.
Yeah. Well, great advice from you. Change your information for a month and re-engage with people that maybe you don't agree with.
Right.
See how you feel at the end of the month or 6 months or wherever it takes you, right? So.
Yeah, I would hope that we might see some progress that way.
Ira Hyman, a professor of psychology at Western Washington University. It's really important to talk about where we are with information and to get people to think and just reopen themselves, I think. So it's great to hear you. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Todd May joins us now from Nevada, and he is a former professor of philosophy here in the UK. He was at Kent University, where he was a professor, and he's now living in America, and he has Philosophy to You, Philosophical Counseling, Facilitation, and Coaching in Meaningful Work and Business Ethics. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Dana. Pleasure to be here.
Your head must be spinning, right? Because you left the UK in September, and you've landed now in the middle of what was an election campaign, and America has just been spinning on its head ever since.
Yes, it's been sort of crazy. And obviously, a lot of things have changed for both the US and the UK since September. And I think what stood out mostly when we first got back, it varied state to state, just the different practices and guidelines and policies that were in place for social distancing and being safe. And to give you an example,
or not in place.
And on the on that point, we had to travel through Utah at one point by car, and we stopped off in a small town. I won't say which one, but nobody was wearing a mask. We, my wife and I, were the only two people wearing a mask. And when we went in to a restaurant to get some food to take out, we got stares, probably for various reasons, but no doubt because we were wearing masks, and it felt very unsafe. And just going across the border to Colorado, we had to stay in a hotel, and then it was entirely different. There were signs up, making sure that people were social distancing and wearing masks. So very different cultures and climates, depending on what state you go to. And my own point of view, anecdotally, is that I often wonder, outside of large cities, why there's such a problem in the United States, because unlike most European countries, there is so much geographical space. And it seems like it's so easy to social distance and keep to oneself because of the way in which one's houses are located, the amount of property you have. Outside of big cities, it just seems like there should not be a problem with social distancing. But that's obviously not the case, given the infection rates in the United States.
Well, philosophically, since you are the philosopher, I mean, this was generated by a president who saw mask wearing as some great infringement on people's rights, or at least he sold it, believing that that would bring him more votes.
Yes, and I suppose the problem from my own perspective is that there's a real lack of understanding and awareness of what philosophers like to call public reasoning, public debate. And it's exacerbated by the fact that social media is, most of the social media companies are aware of this kind of thing. In fact, I emailed one of the legal officers of Facebook at one point, trying to ask him whether, I've forgotten his name now, but ask him about whether Facebook had an interest in this idea of public reasoning, and what it meant practically for something like Facebook is that there would be clear rules of how the people on Facebook would engage with one another. There's, in a simple sense, there's etiquette. There's ways in which you respond and ways in which you speak or write to one another on these kinds of things. Very basic rules of engagement and conversation that many generations prior to ours are probably very much aware of. And there's just no interest on that from social media companies.
There might be now, Todd, right? For a long time it was I think First Amendment was an excuse, but before First Amendment freedom of speech issues, it was simply Facebook didn't want to police this stuff, and neither did Twitter, and they didn't want to bring in the manpower and the women power to go through all these horrible messages and messaging and groups of people. And now suddenly they've really been brought to the precipice, right? I mean, would you agree now that probably you should be calling them back?
Yeah, maybe I'll try that after the podcast goes live. Yeah, so I think there is some kind of social corporate responsibility that has to take place, and they really have to focus on that. But there's also the other side. It's not just the companies, because you hear a lot of blame about company social media being a problem, and it is problematic, and I have to admit I'm a little cynical on that side. But it's also the responsibility of citizens, and the idea of public reasoning and public debate is that you're very much aware of the kinds of claims you're making in the public sphere. A lot of people today, when they're out on social media or they're out in public, they like to express their convictions very strongly. Either way, it could be right or left. And philosophers are interested in the way in which a lot of our beliefs and attitudes don't have the kind of grounding and certainty that we often think they do. So we often teach philosophy students about what's technically called forms of skepticism. But it's not skepticism where you just throw your hands up and you say, oh, there's nothing I can say or do because it's very difficult for me to prove something. Rather, the role of skepticism, as it comes from ancient Greek and Hellenistic philosophy, is that you're very much aware of the weaknesses and fallibility of your own reasoning. So you can't just go out there and say, this is true no matter what, that's fake news, or this is a violation of my rights, mask wearing is a violation of my rights. No, there's always a kind of awareness of you might be speaking from a certain point of view. And when you engage with another person, they're speaking from a certain point of view. And it's the idea that no one comes from an incorrigible or certain point of view that has some kind of access to irrefutable knowledge. But what you get a lot in the public sphere is the lack of that, lack of awareness of what knowledge is and what how to justify beliefs. And so what replaces that are a lot of emotive comments or a lot of emotive reactions, and that tends to galvanize people. And I'm not against emotions. I think emotions have a very important role in our in understanding others. But when you have too much of that, you get what we have today, not just in the U.S.
How do you go about teaching, you know, humility and respect for other people's opinion in the climate, the political climate in America right now?
Yeah, there's got to be a lot of approaches. I'm always a big fan of a liberal arts education. And the problem with that is it isolates people.
You said the liberal arts?
Liberal arts.
You said the liberal word. Oh, my God.
Well, it's very different. It's not political. So it means technically or originally liberal arts is the liberating arts. So you engage in these forms of academic disciplines like philosophy, history, and the imaginative arts, literature, and so forth. And it's the combination of all those exposure to that actually liberates your mind. It makes you more capable of engaging with one another. And what we have today is the lack of that capability of people to engage with one another. It's just people throwing up walls, being angry, condemning people for holding a point of view, or you see someone and you have this reaction of, oh, that person must be a socialist or that person must be a right-wing fanatic, that kind of thing. And it's too reactive. And so the role of reasoning helps to space things out a bit. Now, so there's the liberal arts education, but a lot of people don't have access to that. And so that I don't want that to be a kind of isolating or alienating view. I mean, it'd be great if education were universal in that sense. But there are other things that people can do just on a daily practical basis. And it's making sure that when you engage with someone, you hold off on any quick reactions and you try to understand the point of view from which someone else is speaking. And there are certain kinds of questions and phrases that can help facilitate that. And it's simply asking, I don't quite understand what your view is. And here are some simple questions. And instead of antagonistic questions, they can be open-ended questions. And the other thing I've noticed in conversations with people who hold different views is there tends to be a lack of patience and space. And so I think the other thing is identifying those kinds of conversations where that patience is simply not there and just removing oneself from that. And that happens a lot on social media.
So it's the whole digital world that I mean, it's interesting, some of the analysis where people talk about the fact that, you know, in the end, you used to interact with your neighborhood. So your neighborhood now, you probably closed the door, especially in a pandemic, but we've closed the door to a lot of our neighbors and more kind of human interaction. And now we're in these chat rooms and digitally. And there's something about that environment that gets people not to listen, but to express opinion.
Yes, very problematic. And it comes down to self-restraint and discipline and understanding how to be virtuous on social media, which is very difficult, very hard not to react. And then again, it comes back to the social media companies, and they have to, at the very least, I don't know too much about the tech side, but they got to change the algorithms by which the only things that appear are things that seem to be your preference.
Sure. I mean, I hate Trump. I'm not saying that personally, but that will bring you a lot of people who hate Trump. Or I hate Biden. That will bring you a lot of people who in that echo chamber of the technology to keep you engaged. And they try to keep you engaged by bringing you opinion that they think will, you know, agree with yours. And there's lots of things that are dangerous about it. In a bigger scope, in terms of democracy, do you think that we're entering this period of kind of like mob rule in democracy that Plato talked about? And maybe you can, he wasn't, from what I could understand of Plato, you spend a lifetime studying this stuff. He didn't seem to be a huge fan of democracy in the sense that he felt that it would degenerate into anarchy.
Yeah, so the comments on democracy often are taken from the Republic, which is a very interesting text, and it's got a lot of different ways you can understand what's going on there. Plato, let me just say, Plato's very egalitarian in many ways. I mean, he seems to advocate a form of feminism or proto-feminism, depending how you read him, and the public philosopher Martha Nussbaum comments on that. But Plato had two worries about democracy, and I don't want to pigeonhole him as saying he's just out-and-out anti-democratic, as someone like Karl Popper might say. But his two concerns are, one is that the amount of freedom that occurs in a democracy can, while it's its strength, can actually be its weakness. And I'll come back to that in a moment. And the other weakness that Plato worried about was that there could be the dominance of the emotions and the lack of what I spoke about earlier, the lack of public reasoning to help balance that out. So going back to the first one about having too much freedom. So it's the best way to capture that is this idea that everyone seems to want more choice. And you often hear people, if I can say proponents of neoliberalism, saying that choice is good. The more choice, the better. And it sounds, on the face of it, that sounds really nice. But what it presupposes or what it presumes is that the people who have the choice have some kind of either perfect rationality or access to perfect information, or that they themselves are capable to reason about the choices. And that's not always the case. I mean, you can just, when you go to buy a used or new car, you might have a lot of information, but you don't have all the information to make the best choice possible. So the choice can often be, can often cause a lot of problems. We might make the wrong decisions. And also what Hannah Arendt comments, that what you have in these kinds of situations is there tends to be a lack of concern for the common good and for concern for others. And what tends to replace it is this form of just following the freedoms that arise in society, whether they're brought about by companies or whatever it might be. And so Hannah Arendt says what replaces this concern for the common good is a form of consumerism or behaviorism that just simply follows the choices. And so we're not very discriminating in the things that are presented to us. And so going back to Plato, what happens is you have an erosion of the civil society that's no longer focused on what is authentically or genuinely good for everyone or for the city state, but just simply panders to our appetites.
And it doesn't help if you're making choices based on false information, such as a president telling you that the choice you made in an election didn't count or was cheated. So you roll disinformation in there and chaos becomes supercharged.
Yes, and we need not just institutions, but individual citizens need to know the ways in which they can vet information that's coming across their computers or the TV screens. And you're the journalist and media, and one of the big differences I've noticed between the United States and the UK is that in the UK, whether you're listening to the BBC or Sky, for example, which tend to be both left and right, just left and right of center, you can listen to either of them, and they tend not to yell at you, or they tend to let, in a lot of the major programs, unless it's an op-ed piece, they'll let the news speak for itself. They won't comment on it and try to sway the audience one way or the other. Back in the States,
I was watching Piers Morgan this week, so I'm not sure you're right.
Okay, well, I suppose you know, there's exceptions everywhere. I can generalize. It seems on the whole,
it's a bit more civilized.
A little bit more civilized. Whereas here, I just feel like you can turn on anything from Fox to CNN, and they're just yelling at you constantly.
Last question to you, Todd. I mean, if you reach deep in your philosophical soul and roots and you look at what's happening at the Capitol and where America is headed, what do you draw on to be positive or to be negative?
I think, and I think it's reflected in some of the comments you've made on social media, is that we have to find a way to stop this divide of just thinking it's either us or them, and that's it. And there are different philosophical tools that we can use to help initiate that. But let me just end on a practical note, and this is not my idea. I wish I could take credit for it. But I was speaking with a former senior officer who used to work for the FDA here in the United States, and he recognized that, look, the reason why this is happening is largely due to the socioeconomic divide. And we have to find a way to bring different citizens of different classes, socioeconomic classes and races together. And he thought that the idea of mandatory national service, which could either be military or civil, would bring the different classes together and work together into different projects. And I thought that was a wonderful idea. And it was in view of something called, you know, your nation, whether it's the United States or not. And it's those kinds of experiences that can open many doors and can expose people to things they'd never been exposed to before and can bring people together.
Tough sell in America. But Todd May, thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Dana. Thank you for having me.
And that's our backstory on radicalization in America. The Guardian newspaper here in the UK reported that as many as two-thirds of U.S. adults between the ages of 18 and 39 didn't know that 6 million Jews were killed during the Holocaust. Another 23% of respondents said they believed the Holocaust was either a myth or had been exaggerated or were unsure. Time to roll out a reality check for those with radical views or people that just don't know. Anyway, keep your sense of humor and look forward. This week, Trump is out of the White House, and the pounding of the drum of division and disinformation has been replaced to some extent by some normalcy in Washington. I mean, with the suspension of his Twitter account, it feels less stressful. But online, we have to snuff out hatred. I'm Dana Lewis. Thanks for listening. Please share our podcast, and I'll talk to you again soon.